ashes abound. All you fascists are bound to lose. Well, I'm going into this battle, gonna take my Union gun. All you fascists abound. Gonna end this world of slavery, for this war is won. And all you fascists abound. I'm gonna tell all you fascists.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll feature a special report. Why is a third of the population of Venezuela on the run from one of the most oil-rich countries in the world? And Frontline investigative reporter Greg Palast is back for another edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin. What's Trump got to do with this? Got to do with this a lot. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network out of the San Francisco Bay Area over KPFA, 75 years old. This year, we're happy to have you along, and we continue with our work. And we start off, well, looking at what's been happening at the border and what that has to do with Venezuela and why there are so many Venezuelans showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border. Joining us to talk about this is somebody who knows a great deal about immigration and about what happens in Central America in terms of U.S. relationships, U.S. power relationships that force migration, force people out of their own countries. Joining us is Adrian Pine. Adrian Pine is a medical anthropologist who has previously taught at the San Quentin Prison, UC Berkeley, and American University in Washington, D.C. Her work centers on empire neoliberal fascism, health, justice, asylum, and somatic solidarity. Her first book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard on Violence and Survival in Honduras, explores the embodiment and the culturalization as everyday violence of imperialist capitalism in Honduras. Her second book is Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Asylum Industry. We're going to talk about all these things. It is so good to have you back with us, Adrian Pline. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dennis. Great to be here.
All right, well, can we talk a little bit about Venezuela in the context of this immigration, migration, let's call it a forced migration crunch that's happening now. Why so many Venezuelans? Give us a little of the history.
Sure. Well, Venezuela, up until 2015, was a net receiving country for migrants. It was doing quite well, actually. I mean, it has the largest reserves of oil in the world. And, of course, under Chavez, the socialist programs had provided health and education and all sorts of things that had tremendously increased the quality of life for the vast majority of Venezuelans. In 2015, former President Obama issued the first sanctions against Venezuela as a supposed enemy country of the United States. And it's really with the sanctions, which are a form of collective punishment, that we see migration begin, people begin to leave Venezuela. And so in the following years, in the subsequent years, as conditions became harsher and harsher for Venezuelans because the United States was not only, and sanctions, I want to clarify, it's not just the U.S. is not engaging in trade with a certain country, it's actually punishing other countries if they would trade with Venezuela, and effectively blocking its major industry, which was the oil industry, because of those reserves. And so what that meant initially in those first few years is that Venezuela just had a huge hit to its economy. It was not able to import food. It was not able to import medicines, even when it did have the money, because of the U.S. unilateral coercive measures. And people were suffering under them. And so people started leaving. You had a lot of Venezuelans going to other South American countries, Colombia, Chile, and being treated quite badly in those countries. Originally, they were received well, but they very quickly were subject to the sorts of stereotypes that people fleeing poverty are subject to as migrants. So there are a lot of xenophobic stereotypes about Venezuelans, a lot of terrible mistreatment. Of course, in 2019, the United States attempted to very pathetically to orchestrate a coup against the elected President Maduro of Venezuela by throwing this guy who nobody had ever heard of, Juan Guaido, in front of a crowd, and he self-proclaimed himself president, having won no election that was indicative of, that had anything to do with the presidency. And with that, of course, the Trump administration immediately recognized him, and that further punished the people of Venezuela by giving the Trump administration and then subsequently the Biden administration an excuse to basically steal billions of dollars of Venezuelan wealth. This is through its allies, including the Bank of England, which had $100 billion of Venezuelan gold, basically stealing all of Citgo's assets, which is a Venezuelan corporation. So then this, again, intensified the collective punishment against Venezuelans. And so Venezuelans, very understandably, many of them, chose to try their luck going abroad, where they had a better chance at, at at making more money than they were able to, at eating better than they were able to in Venezuela. So this created, you know, a crisis for Venezuelans abroad, a migration crisis in the eyes of many people throughout South America. And it's more recently that Venezuelans in larger numbers have been making the trek, the very dangerous trek through the Darien Gap toward Central America and then Mexico and ultimately to the United States, only to find that while the United States has been using the migration, the very increased out-migration of Venezuelans in a really cynical propagandistic way to claim that they're fleeing a dictatorship, when in fact it's quite clear that what they're fleeing is sanctions, is U.S.-led unilateral coercive measures, nonetheless they are not accepting Venezuelans with open arms when they come fleeing those same unilateral coercive measures, which the United States claims is a dictatorship. And so they're being, you know, they're coming to the U.S. border thinking that they're going to get a warm welcome because this is the rhetoric of the United States. And they're finding that the reality is very different.
They're different. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Adrian Pine. She's an anthropologist, a medical anthropologist, and who was spent much time abroad seeing the other side of U.S. foreign policy. You spent a great deal of time, I know, in Honduras and have written about that as well. It really does seem, what you're describing here is essentially asylum used as a political weapon in the failure, you know, as a part of the failure of U.S. foreign policy, right? And that's, we see the crush at the border. We see the implications of this kind of sort of Monroe Doctrine policy 200 years after the Monroe Doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that's important to note, while I have just mentioned that Venezuelans are having a hard time like any other nationality crossing the border right now, they're not having a harder time than anybody else. Mm-hmm. They nonetheless, over the past, since Chavez came to power, they have statistically been granted asylum at much higher rates than people coming from countries where there were actually full dictatorships, like Honduras under Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is being tried in the U.S. Southern District Court in New York for major drug trafficking and weapons offenses while he was president. So you've got this U.S.-supported narco-dictator who was directly responsible for countless targeted assassinations and the incredible intentional impoverishment of his country. The people who are fleeing that situation are systematically being denied asylum at much higher levels than Venezuelans, who by and large are economic migrants. So it's this, as you were mentioning, asylum is a political tool. It is very much a political tool. And I say this as somebody who has served as an expert witness in well over 100 cases, serving as an expert witness for country conditions for Honduras. I've become pretty familiar with how asylum courts work, and it's a performance. And one of the first things I do when I take on a new case is to look up the judge. Syracuse University has this great program where they provide the statistics, the acceptance rates of every immigration judge around the country. And there's just an incredible disparity in acceptance rates of asylum applicants, but also, again, by country. Countries that are perceived as enemies to the United States, those people are more likely to be granted asylum than countries that are not perceived as enemies of the United States, regardless of the actual violence that is happening, that is targeting certain specific populations in those countries.
You know, I couldn't help but think of the irony. Hillary Clinton has clearly been very high profile about what she feels about the Russian involvement in U.S. elections. But am I remembering correctly, as Secretary of State under Obama, she sustained a coup in Honduras? I think you were there at the time.
She very much did sustain a coup in Honduras, and in fact bragged about preventing the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, from returning to his elected presidency in Honduras. And that was in her book, Hard Choices. Apparently, it wasn't that hard of a choice for her to overthrow numerous elected democracies that she did not agree with. And, that's really sort of the hawkish stance of Democrats in migration policy. Of course, we're seeing this with Joe Biden right now, is that they're trying to outdo Republicans in the implementation of xenophobic policies. And of course, right now, with the end of Title 42 last week on May 11th, Title 42, of course, being the expressly xenophobic white nationalist policy implemented in a white nationalist way, I should say, by Stephen Miller, who was the white nationalist assistant to President Trump, using the excuse of public health threat to deny people the right, their international right to seek asylum. That policy, Title 42, ended last week. And so, you know, there's been this whole panic, both among Republicans and Democrats, that, oh no, this is going to mean this huge influx at the border, and we have to do something to stem migration, which again is completely ignoring the fact that so many of these people, tens of thousands of people at the border, are migrating because they're seeking asylum, because they are at risk of being tortured or murdered in their home countries, generally for reasons that involve U.S. intervention and counterinsurgency projects. And so the Democrats under Biden are actually trying to out xenophobia Trump, I would say, in their actual policies to replace Title 42.
Right, they did. And in the middle, there was a big scare, right? And it does seem like they used this to really carry forth with an immigration crackdown. And some of that policy is incredibly cynical and dangerous, Dane. If you don't apply from a third country, then you can't apply for asylum when you get. I mean, it really is cynical to the point of being a bit diabolical, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And what you're referring to is Biden's circumvention of lawful pathways, or what we call, those of us who are working in asylum are calling an asylum ban. Actually, the ACLU and a couple other organizations filed a legal challenge just a few days ago to the ban, because it largely mimics two Trump-era policies, which are the entry and transit ban. So the transit ban is what you're referring to. If people have not applied for asylum in a third country, then they enter the United States without legal permission to enter the United States, then they're deported, not only deported, but they're prevented from entering again for 5 years, I believe. And so in that way, it's actually harsher than Title 42. And they're sort of talking about lawful pathways, but the lawful pathways they've created are just incredibly burdensome. And again, this is new with the Biden administration. They've introduced this app through which all asylum applicants are now required to basically have a metering system. This is replacing what was called the Romanian-Mexico policy. So migrants have to download this incredibly confusing app that is only available in three languages, Spanish, English, and Haitian Creole. And so anybody else who doesn't speak one of those languages is just completely, they're screwed. There's nothing they can do. And the app has all sorts of flaws in it. In addition, you know, there are many reports of it just completely failing, you know, and it assumes that all of these applicants have access to Wi-Fi, that they have a functioning cell phone that can use this app that actually uses a whole lot of data. And it still makes them wait, sometimes months and months at a time, in what's basically a lottery to get a chance to cross the border to exercise what was always their international right to seek asylum. And so that's, you know, the quote-unquote lawful pathway. And I should add that it uses facial recognition technology, which was tested on white men, and so it doesn't really work that well on everybody else. There have been extensive studies showing that it regularly fails on black people, for example. So there's just, the Biden's replacements for Title 42 and for Remaining Mexico are proving to be even more dangerous, I would say, than Trump's policies. And they certainly have been, again, deporting people without any sort of due process at a record pace.
It does feel like, it's hard to say, but the way in which the Biden administration played the border fear, it was almost a cover for this immigration crackdown. And I have to say, I almost fell off my chair when I heard one of the Biden officials say that Biden is actually, his new program for immigration is transformational, revolutionary, some of the most important immigration policy in decades. That's what they were saying. What's his face? Head of Security was spelled. Yes.
Mayorkas?
That was, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what can you say about the Biden policy? What he's doing is making all of this happen through technology. So it really removes the sort of xenophobic rhetoric of Trump, and it removes the culpability of individual agents or agencies, but nonetheless it's having the same impact. So the CBP One app, as I mentioned, is fundamentally racist because of the face recognition, because of the fact that it does not that it's only in these three languages. And then, you know, you've got other sort of technological things going on where now their geo group is forcing people, they have them wearing ankle bracelets, which is just so tremendously humiliating. And now they're forcing them all to wear apps. So they're geolocating everybody, whether they're in Mexico trying to get permission to come to request asylum, or they're in the United States. You've got, you know, they're starting to do credible fear interviews in CBP facilities, the Border Patrol facilities, which make ICE jails look like a walk in the park. They're much more abusive. And again, this is a way to fast track deportations. And then, of course, Biden has actually sent, you know, they're militarizing the border even further than Trump had done. They sent all of they're training all of these new folks to go down and militarize the border, and they're also he's invested billions in basically an electronic wall, all sorts of new technologies to monitor and penalize people for attempting to exercise their international right to seek asylum. So, I mean, one of the things, there have been a couple of positive moves. Certainly, all of the asylum organizations, I'm talking about hundreds of organizations, nonprofits, legal groups, have come out very strongly opposing Biden's really shameful anti-immigrant new, you know, replacements for Remain in Mexico and Title 42. Also, just last week, 21 progressive representatives came out, sent a letter, and led by Veronica Escobar of Texas and Raul Grijalva of Arizona, sent a letter urging Biden to reverse the sanctions on Cuba and Venezuela, which, you know, we talked about earlier, serve as what we call push factors for the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, there's all this talk about deterrence, but if we want to truly exercise deterrence, we need to stop screwing up people's countries.
Right. Listen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us again, Adrienne Pine. You're going to have to come back. We're out of time. We're in the middle of doing some other kinds of business to keep the station going. But your work, I want to say, is amazing. You not too long ago, are the co-editor of the book. I believe it was called Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. You've written earlier a very powerful book, your first book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard on Violence and Survival in Honduras. You're a wonderful anthropologist. We thank you for joining us, and we hope that you will come back.
Thank you so much. It's always great to talk with you, Dennis.
All right. Be safe. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and it is time now for another edition of, you guessed it, the Election Crimes Bulletin.
This whole election is being rigged.
The election is being rigged.
It's totally rigged.
Yes, Donald, it's rigged because your cronies rigged it.
So says Rolling Stone investigative reporter Greg Palast.
You're removing black voters from the voter rolls just so you can win this election?
We will treat those people from January 6th fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
So you didn't call him, but you challenged his right to vote or have his ballot challenged.
Sir, get out of my house.
Okay, I will get out of your house.
House.
I just...
Now.
It's now time for your Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast.
And this is Dennis Bernstein with Greg Palast. Every time I hear that, I get a chuckle based on remembering the... after the chuckle is how serious your film is, Vigilantes, about what we are facing. This is not in the past, Greg Palast. What's happening to the elections and the loss of our ability to vote is in progress and ain't getting better. Would that be an exaggeration, Greg?
No, in fact, it's been really seriously underplayed. I think we have to go back to Trump's town hall meeting from last week, and the media missed one of the most dangerous things that Trump took on, which is he was claiming, we got a little clip from that film, from his town hall, about 20 seconds there. So I want you to listen to this. This is Trump claiming that there are millions of votes, ballots, that were stuffed into the ballot boxes in 2020. This is dangerous stuff. We have responded to it, but I want you to listen to what Trump is claiming, because this could change what he's doing. I'll explain, could change the outcome of the 2024 election, whether he's the nominee or not. Mike, do you have that first clip?
If you look at True the Vote, they found millions of votes on camera, on government cameras, where they were stuffing ballot boxes. If you look at what happened in Atlanta, millions of votes, and all you have to do is take a look at government cameras, you'll see them. People going to 28 different voting booths to vote, to put in seven ballots apiece.
But Mr. President, and they're all on camera. I have to stop you there.
Okay, what you've just heard is more what to translate Trump's brain vomit, the general blather there. He is saying that in Atlanta, there were millions of votes, first of all, or millions of votes in Atlanta. Millions of votes stuffed into ballot boxes in Atlanta. Most African Americans in Atlanta voted by using their absentee ballot and putting them in drop boxes, not counting on the post office to get the ballots there in time because of the special law in Georgia that the ballot has to be received by the end of election day. So literally, a couple hundred thousand black Atlantans, almost entirely black Atlantans, use these drop boxes. And they claim that basically black men, and it's all black men in this film, he talked about True the Vote, in their film, 2,000 Mules, which was, you know, launched at Mar-a-Lago, that in their film they showed black men stuffing ballot boxes illegally, even though, and they're saying they have all the film because it's true that every ballot box has cameras on it 24/7, and they keep claiming they've got the video evidence. And I'll explain why this is dangerous, but first, from the, my film Vigilante, we actually took on the 2,000 Mules claim, True the Vote claim, that one guy went to 28 boxes and stuffed a bunch of ballots in 28 different boxes, and we took on the claim that they stuffed millions of ballots in these boxes. Here's a clip from the film Vigilante. Can you roll that, Mike?
Now, today, there's a new film.
2,000 Mules, live from Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Former President Donald Trump, live on SalemNewsChannel.com.
It's the new birth of a nation. And once again, it says that black men, by the thousands, commit voter fraud. They vote several times.
This particular individual we have in a number of different locations. He's actually a mule.
Now, dig this. Every single drop box in Georgia has a security camera on it. And the 2,000 Mules guys say this voter has dumped ballots in 27 drop boxes, and they have the videotapes. But oddly, they don't show the 27 videotapes. They show the same tape over and over.
This is a smoking gun. This is O.J. Simpson being seen leaving the scene of the crime.
So, did you see O.J. Simpson leaving the scene of the crime?
No, I mean, let me tell you what I saw. You know, this is the complexity and the nuance of racism in America. That by the very presence of who he is, he's considered guilty.
And then to call a human being a mule.
Yeah.
A man who literally is getting out his car, doing his democratic duty to go vote, and to refer to him as a mule. I mean, full stop. Where do we go from there?
Okay, Dennis, that last voice you heard was Latosha Brown, a fellow at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, but best known as the co-founder of Black Voters Matter. And what we had there, what you were listening to, was the basis of Donald Trump's claim that black men were literally stuffing ballot boxes, ballot drop boxes with millions of votes, and in particular, he names one who goes around to 28 boxes, and they claim they have the videotape. They don't show us. Well, it turns out that one of these guys that they claim was going around to all these different boxes, his name is Mark Andrews. He saw his face on YouTube from True the Vote, and he sued them. As it turns out, he was hunted down by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation because of this claim by Trump gangsters. He was hunted down. And because he put five ballots in a ballot box, right? And they were correct. Yeah, he was stuffing that ballot box with five ballots. His ballot, his wife's ballot, and his three adult children. And the Georgia FBI, Bureau of Investigation, their own FBI, even though they're kind of a right-wing group working under Brian Kemp, they were furious. Yeah. They actually said, you know, filing false, making false charges of crimes and sending the Georgia Bureau of Investigation all over the state. We went to one voter after another who were on that tape, and they showed us their registrations and their ballot receipts. They're all legal voters, every single one of them. Every ballot was legal. And then the Secretary of State had all the ballot drop boxes, all the drop box votes reviewed, counted by hand, and the signatures matched. And there wasn't one single fraudulent ballot, not one extra ballot. Now, this is not about debunking what Trump says about 2020. If it was just him blathering and these freaks from True the Vote, who, because they refused to even respond to the suit, they ended up going to jail, by the way, for contempt of court. But this would be, so you say, okay, more Trump fun and games. Here's why it's not fun and games, Dennis. Because this has been a very, very effective game campaign by Trump and the GOP against ballot drop boxes because, are you ready? 25 million Americans used them, overwhelmingly Democrats. It was the main method of voting for African Americans in many, many states, from Texas to Georgia to Arizona to Michigan and Wisconsin, which is why Biden is president, and they know it. Without those ballot drop box votes for minority voters, it would Trump would be in his second term right now. And they know that whether Trump wins or not. So, for example, in Georgia, the same Republican officials who debunked it and declared not one fraudulent ballot, these same Republican officials have passed a law that cut the number of drop boxes in Georgia by 75%, and now there's a new law they proposed to completely eliminate drop boxes. In Wisconsin, which Biden only won by 10,000 votes, completely from the ballot drop boxes in Madison from the students, in Milwaukee from African-American voters, a right-wing organization won a court order to completely eliminate those drop boxes at the schools and in minority areas in Wisconsin. This could flip Wisconsin, whether it's Trump or any other guy the GOP puts up. And by the way, the lawsuit that won them the prohibition on drop boxes in Wisconsin was funded by the Bradley Family Foundation, which funded this berserko, libelous, defamatory, lying film, 2,000 Mules. The same money in
Amazing.
Texas. In Texas, they got around, they had a prohibition on drop boxes. So brilliantly, this is the, by the way, Houston is one of the, has the largest, just, I think it's the largest black population in America of any city, and one of the closest. And in Houston, Harris County, they got around the drop box prohibition by simply saying, okay, we'll have an election worker next to a drop box, and they can check your ID and everything else. So they had 24/7 voting in Houston. And they now have prohibited the Republican legislature, Republican governor has prohibited. You're saying the same attack in Michigan, the same attack in Arizona, the same attack
Amazing.
In Florida.
Greg, let me just jump in here. Got to take a break. Let me just jump in here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. That's Greg Palast. He's going to stay with us here in the Bay Area. Some other folks will hear some interesting stuff that we've done on the farm workers. We'll be back. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The show is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And Miguel Gavilán Molina, who started as a child, as he says, in the fields of misery, is back out there again, marching with the people. Stay tuned.
This is Miguel Gavilán Molina, reporting for Flashpoints. Here we are today. It's Wednesday, August the 3rd, 2022, and we find ourselves in Delano, California, on the epic pilgrimage spiritual walk that's been taking place today from Delano to Sacramento, a 335-mile walk, which will take 24 days. And today, the weather has been okay. There's a little breeze in the shade, but not in the sunlight.
Take inside and take inside. No, you have a photo with me. Take inside and take inside. Conmigo toda la vida. Me dicen que soy muy necia. Gritona y ojota perros. Me dicen que soy muy necia.
My name is Free Welland Franklin, and tonight we are sharing some sounds from the UFW and their march slash pilgrimage to the governor's office to demand his signature on AB 2183, the right to unionize without fear of intimidation or retaliation. The march will be 24 days and 335 miles in the summer heat of the Central Valley of California. To get some more background on this pilgrimage, let's check out this interview with United Farm Workers President Teresa Romero, produced by First Voice graduate Sarah Blanco.
Hello, I'm Sarah Blanco, and joining us today is Teresa Romero, president of the United Farm Workers, the UFW. She has been president for over 3.5 years. She was formerly the secretary, treasurer for the UFW, and prior to joining the UFW, she managed a construction company and a law firm that helped workers with immigration and workers' compensation claims. She is an immigrant from Mexico. Teresa will be talking with us about the upcoming upcoming march from Delano to Sacramento, a pilgrimage for 24 days and 335 miles, where people will walk from Delano, California to Sacramento, starting on August 3rd. And it is for California Governor Gavin Newsom's signature on AB 2183, the California Ag Labor Relations Voting Choice Act. Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Can you start first with maybe sharing one story, just something that's notable for you as you went along your journey to becoming the first Latina and first immigrant woman to become president of a national union in the United States? Something that comes to mind.
You know, Sarah, when I started working for the union, I thought I was going to be working for the union for a couple of years. It was at the time where the recession started. One of the first things that goes, you know, slows down is construction. So I decided, you know, that I needed to find a job just in case. And I started working with the union thinking I'll be here for a couple of years and then I'll go back to my business. When I started talking to the people that we represent, when I started interacting with them, when I started just understanding the challenges that they have, I thought to myself, I'm not going anywhere. And of course, I never thought I would become the president of the United Farm Workers. I remember my dad was very ill when the union decided that I would become the person that was going to succeed Arturo. And I went to see them because I got a note from my sister that he was not responding. So I went to see them and I'm talking to him and I'm telling him, I hope he's proud of me the union has decided that I was going to be the president of the UFW. But my dad had no reaction. And like at 3 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up. He has a big smile because we all are there. He doesn't realize that how ill he is. And when I was giving him something to eat, all of a sudden he stops and he says, "How come you're going to be the president of the United States?" And I thought it was just so, you know, in his unconsciousness, he heard what he wanted to hear. I was sharing, I'm going to be the president of the UFW, and I hope he's proud of me. But he heard something else. So he went to his grave thinking that I was going to be the president of the United States.
Oh, what a beautiful story. I love hearing especially that you were able to have that conversation, and also that it sounds like it's all of the good work that UFW has done and the people themselves and the workers themselves that really helped you stay motivated to want to do the job.
Absolutely. And you know what? They still motivate me to continue to do the job. There are many challenges that we have to face. But knowing at the end, I remember another thing. There were times at the beginning when I was so frustrated. And I would get home and I would say, why am I doing this? Why did I say yes? And one day my daughter says, why do you say yes, Mom? And my immediate answer without even thinking about it was, for the benefit of farm workers, of course. She said, okay, so that's why you're doing it. But they keep me focused. They keep me grounded. They motivate me to work harder because they work so hard to put food on our tables. They are the people that we need to be thinking about, because without them, we wouldn't have the food that we enjoy every day.
Absolutely. And let's be real, the challenges that farm workers faced long before the COVID pandemic were extreme, right? Many workers don't face a lot of those challenges.
You know, farm workers have a difficult job and have had it for many decades. And when the pandemic hit, we were so blessed that we had supporters that donated masks that we could distribute to farm workers, and especially in the farms that we don't have a contract, because we knew that that's where they were going to need them. They gave us cleaning supplies, and we were able to distribute that. But unfortunately, you know, I had the benefit of being able to work remotely. Many of us did. They didn't. And because also they're mostly undocumented, all the programs that were approved by the federal government excluded farm workers because they're not documented. And it was, you know, adding insult to injury. They're working in some areas where the temperatures as you know, are getting hotter and hotter in Washington and Oregon. We're having temperatures right now of 110 degrees, where that wasn't heard of. And we have been able to pass laws that would protect farm workers, now also including Oregon and Washington, to protect them from the heat, the high temperatures, where they could have a rest period, where they can ensure the workers are going to have fresh water, cold fresh water as they work during the day, where they're going to have a shaded area. So when they have lunch or where they have a break, they have a shaded area where they can rest for a few minutes. That has saved lives and will continue to save lives. But we need to add to that the fact that the fires the last few years have been tremendous. And farm workers continue to work in areas where the air quality is horrendous. But again, we have been able to receive donations of N95 masks that we have been able to distribute to those areas, and making sure that the workers are aware of the rights and know that wearing the mask is going to protect them some from the air quality. But it's not an easy job. It's, the challenges are there in our everyday. And I have the honor of representing people who work hard, give it their all, and are proud of the work that they do. But we want to make sure that these workers are recognized and they have the same protections that other workers have. And when you have in places like Oregon, the law says that a 12-year-old can work in the fields. It's just, tell me any other job that a 12-year-old legally can do. It's just not fair.
And the idea that, you know, a lot of us got to work from home, whereas they had to go in, who knows what kind of conditions they were traveling there in with other people, right? Couldn't isolate potentially either at work or in transportation or even at home. I mean, I also think about just some of the basic work of stooping or to be hunched over for any long period of time. So the struggles are definitely many. And so Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta had long been fighting for some basic things like water and bathrooms and such. Just the idea that climate crisis is compounding it all, plus the pandemic. I also think about the simple fact that we could be sitting down in the shade and still get heat exhaustion. It's just unbelievable. Heroes, truly, yes, to put food on our table.
Yes. And you know what? We had invited all 100 U.S. senators to work in the field, just because we are also pushing an immigration bill that would give farm workers a path to legalization, the ability to go to their homes and visit relatives that they haven't seen in years and sometimes decades. And we had two senators that agreed to do it. Senator Alex Padilla from California and Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey. And they did it. They worked in the fields for 6 hours. And I can tell you that at the end of the day, they were exhausted. Their backs were hurting. And we're talking about two senators then that understand that the farm workers have a very important job in our country, not only to put food on our table, but it's our food security. And it gave them a different level of understanding for this workforce. And I think I'm the type of person that I say, you know, the only way you know how difficult it is when you have done it, or when you take the time to listen to farm workers and learn from them their challenges, their fights every day that they have to find the energy to work 8, 10, 12 hours sometimes. If you don't talk to farm workers, not talk to farm workers, if you don't listen to farm workers or have worked in the fields, it is very difficult for anybody to truly understand how challenging this work is.
The UFW is sponsoring a walk with farm workers, a pilgrimage for 24 days and 335 miles, where people will walk from Delano, California to Sacramento in this blazing heat starting on August 3rd. And it is for California Governor Gavin Newsom's signature on AB 2183, the California Ag Labor Relations Voting Choice Act. Late last year, a similar measure, AB 616, was vetoed by California Governor Gavin Newsom. And according to the UFW, it would have allowed workers union voting from home and allow them to cast a secret ballot in many of the same ways that California voters did in the recall election. Protests against this veto were staged on Cesar Chavez Day of this year. And according to the UFW, Governor Gavin Newsom refused to meet with elected worker leaders, even when some marched to Newsom's personally owned winery. Why do the farmer workers have to continuously sacrifice in order to get basic rights? What is the Voting Choice Act?
Sarah, in California, when we vote for elected officials, when we voted for governor, when we voted in the recall, we do it in a way that we have options. You can do it in person if you want. You can get a mail-in ballot if you want. You can ask somebody to help you fill out the ballot if you want. And you can ask somebody to deliver it to the mail or to the voting places if you want to. So those are the things that we want for farm workers. Right now, the only way farm workers can vote, whether or not they want union representation, is at the employer's premises. After farm workers were threatened, some of them fired for the support of a union. So having only that option does not promote participation. We have seen in California that having those options has increased the number of people that are able to vote in whatever election. Last year, we introduced the bill, and during the recall time, do you know what farm workers were doing? They cannot vote because many of them are undocumented, but they were knocking on doors to make sure that people would go and vote against the recall. And a week later, Gavin Newsom vetoed the bill. We are reintroducing the same bill. And unfortunately, every gain that we are able to obtain for farm workers, it is a fight. It is a battle. It takes years. And one of the ways that we as a union have been able to get the attention of legislators, of supporters and governors is by marching, because it is something that nobody else does. Nobody else has marched, 300 miles, 400 miles, whatever it is, to bring attention to the plight of farm workers. And Gavin Newsom knows this is last year and this year, this is the most important bill for farm workers. And we're going to make sure that our supporters, other farm workers, legislators, know, other labor unions know that we are going to sacrifice this much because that's what it takes to get legislation in favor of farm workers. Nothing has been easy for them. So we're willing to go again to this extent to make sure that the governor understands that this is something that if having options to vote for him, it is good enough for him, it should be good enough for farm workers.
And even though the type of voting is different, right? Labor voting for in labor relations or voting for who's governor, the idea is still the same: choice and the right to vote free of harassment. Also important to note that fairly early during the pandemic, Governor Newsom did come out with news about pandemic assistance for farm workers. He also appeared a calming spirit amidst the pandemic. But some notable vetoes on his part include, at the end of 2020, Flashpoints reported that Liberal Governor Newsom vetoed SB 1257, which would have given domestic workers the right to health and safety precautions and protections. We've been speaking with Teresa Romero, president of the United Farm Workers. The UFW is sponsoring a walk with farm workers, a pilgrimage for 24 days and 335 miles. The upcoming pilgrimage will retrace the route of the historic trek that Cesar Chavez led in 1966 from Delano all the way to the state capital in Sacramento. And that was to place farm workers' grievances before the governor and the legislature. Please tell us about kickoff day. Tell us about this pilgrimage. What can we expect along the travels?
We're going to be starting on August 3rd in Delano at 40 Acres, which is a historic site. That's what Caesar organized for many years and continues to be a place where farm workers feel comfortable, At one point, even when we were, you know, trying to get farm workers vaccinated, they were afraid, what if when I give my information, they do something with it? The moment they knew that we were going to get vaccines at 40 acres, thousands of farm workers came to get vaccinated. So that is a historic site. And we're going to be starting on August 3rd. There is in our website, there is already a schedule from where to where each day. And we ask people to join us to make calls to the governor and say, you need to sign this bill. This is important for farm workers. They are the ones that are putting food on our table. And we want to make sure that as many emails, as many calls that our supporters can make, so he understands that this is something that not only the UFW and our movement wants, but also the consumers that are enjoying the fruits of this hard labor are interested and are wanting to get these for farm workers.
Who's actually marching?
We have a number of farm workers that are going to be the full-time workers that are marching. I'm going to be one of those people. I'm going to be marching for full-time. And what we're doing is at every city that we're going to be getting to, and we're going to be starting, many people join us just for that day, for half a day. But it is in solidarity for farm workers. We have a committee that is working on having at the end of the day, you know, a reception of these marchers that are sacrificing so much. People are going to be there. People are going to be bringing some entertainment. In some cases, they want to feed us there. We want to make this a part of the community. They are the people that are benefiting from the sacrifices of the farm workers.
How do you intend to try to keep people safe from the heat and even violence while walking along the roads?
You know, as you know, we're a nonviolent group. Marches that we've had, we have not experienced it. But we're engaging every police station in every town to let them know what we're doing. We're going to have people that are going to be knowledgeable. And if any of our workers, any of our marchers, any of our supporters are showing some signs of any heat illness, we would put them in a car. We would drive them for a mile in an air-conditioned place where they can recuperate themselves and make sure that they're safe. We're not putting anybody in danger. We are making sure that these marchers are going to be protected and that we're not going to, you know, we are the ones that fight for heat illness protections, and we're going to make sure they're enforced.
The kickoff for the Farm Workers March from Delano to Sacramento for Governor Newsom's signature is going to be August 3rd at 8 a.m. at the 40-acre site in Delano, California. It will start at 8 a.m. and I believe they're going to depart at 8:30. There'll be a mass and blessings at 8 a.m. and all walkers will depart at 8:30. So August 3rd from Delano to August 26th to Sacramento. And there is a map on their website that will tell you all of the different stops and journeys. And of course, their website will tell you more about the overall process and history of the UFW. You know, I keep thinking, like, how many times do they need to make a pilgrimage for the same things, you know, over and over, mm-hmm. the same things that countless other workers and job fields already enjoy. I also think about the beauty of this, but it is a very large sacrifice. One, they are putting themselves out there publicly. Two, the heat is intense. And we think about all of these different sacrifices that people make for spiritual reasons and here for basic human rights and a right to vote without intimidation and harassment. I want to thank you so much, Teresa Romero, for joining us. And Flashpoints will be there along the pilgrimage. Is there anything else you'd like people to know or how they can get more information?
They can go to our website. They can call our offices if they want more information. We are wanting them to be a part of this because, like you said, this is historic. And I want to thank Flashpoints for giving us the opportunity to talk about it, for you being there and being part of history, Sarah, because we once again are doing something that we have to work harder, that we have to sacrifice more to get any gains for farm workers when it is time that they're treated like any other worker in this country.
Thank you so much, Teresa Romero.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you very much for really doing this for farm workers.
All right. Thank you. And we'll see you on the road.
We'll see you on the 3rd.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
For Flashpoints, I'm Sarah Blanco.
You just heard First Voice graduate Sarah Blanco speaking with the United Farm Workers president, Teresa Romero. Thank you, Sarah B., and thank you, Teresa, for being such a courageous leader of this historic union, the UFW. That interview first aired on Flashpoints in the lead up to the march to Sacramento for the governor's signature. So fast forward from that interview, and now members of the La Onda and Full Circle crew have packed up and headed down here to Delano for the kickoff of the march. Once we arrived at the world-famous 40-acre site in Delano, there were already hundreds of people gathering there for the kickoff of this historic event. And we kicked off the show with an in-depth interview with Teresa Romero, the current president of the UFW. Now let's hear from these powerful women as they fired up the crowd just before the march began. Here they are speaking to the crowd of 200-plus people who showed up for the kickoff of this historic pilgrimage. And remember, this was a bilingual event, but I did do some editing for our English-speaking audiences. But you will hear a little English and a little Spanish. Check it out.
Vamos a presentar a nuestra líder de la Unión de Campesinos, Teresa Romero, que se encuentra acá detrás de mí. Pásale, Teresa.
Muy buenos días. Good morning, everybody. I want to thank everybody for being here in support of farm workers. These are the people that put food on our tables every single day.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They'll go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.